What is your favorite part of Node.js?
My favorite part of Node.js.
The one thing you like wouldn't change, like you think it's in a really good spot, even if you could snap your fingers and change it, you just leave it alone.
None.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Maybe we need to go to the other side of the question first then. What's the thing that you would change if you could just change it?
All of it.
These are the worst answers ever, Matteo. Oh, or maybe they're the best
simple.
Ones.
Let me articulate this because it's just funny. So Node.js grow too fast, too quickly. Okay.
Welcome back to Backend Banter, the podcast about backend engineering and careers. Today, I have an amazing guest. I honestly can't quite believe that I got him to come on the show. Luckily, someone else on Twitter recommended that I bring him on, and that seems to have done the trick. But this is Matteo Colina. So is it Matteo? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, you are absolutely pronouncing my name correctly. It's absolutely correct, Matteo Colina.
Awesome. I speak Spanish. I don't speak Italian. It's an Italian name. Is that?
Yes, it's an Italian name. I live in Italy.
Yeah. The way I found that out was because I spelled it incorrectly the first time, assuming it was not an Italian name with a single T and a single L, like it would be in Spanish. But we got that corrected.
Yes. Yep.
Cool. So, Matteo, you have a master's in software engineering. You did a PhD on the Internet of Things. You're the CTO of Platformatic, which is a company kind of dedicated to the backend side of the stack, especially in JavaScript. And you are also on the Node.js technical steering committee, which I'm not exactly sure what that means. We'll get to it. But from what I understand, it means you have a lot of kind of weight and things to say about, you know, what Node is going to do next. So did I miss anything there?
Let me think. I created a framework called Fastify. I created a logger called Pino. I have more or less, last year, I did 17 billion downloads on NPM. This year, probably 22 billion downloads.
Did you say 17 billion?
17 billion. Yeah.
Three times the number of, that's like three times the population of Earth, right?
Pretty much, yes. So, as I typically say, you're running my software. Either you know it or you don't. You're running my software. Okay, this is my more or less my summing up my penetration in the industry at this point. It's great. Also, out of responsibilities. So I have probably the best QA team in the world at this point. If I make a mistake, I get slapped very, very quickly. On top of that, I do Node. What else? What else is of real interest? I have a daughter, so I can also find time to have a daughter. This is,
it takes a lot of time. I'm with you there.
It takes time. I have a YouTube channel, a newsletter, and I stream on Twitch from time to time. So. I'm busy.
Is that how you plug your resume just at the very top? Like, you're already running my software. You might as well hire me.
Well, at some point I went one step ahead and I founded a company.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And that's your current project, right? Is Platformatic. Yeah.
Platformatic.
I'm going to screw that up, but it's okay because you'll correct me every time, which is great. Okay, cool. Let's start with Node because I'm guessing your contributions to Node is where most of the, and probably the Fastify framework and stuff is where most of those 17 billion downloads came from.
No, Node does not count on the 17 billions.
What?
Yes, what? Those are
what's the
Node
17
is excluded
billion
from the 17 billions.
Where do they come from?
Modules on NPM. I maintain 500 modules on NPM, something like that.
500?
500 modules on NPM.
Jesus
Christ. I am.
All right, well, I'll be doing
think
some
probably
more
like top
this.
Four author or something. I'm one of. I don't know, something like that.
All right. Okay. So the number is actually 17 billion is the lower bound, it turns out.
Yeah. Next year will be 22, something like that. It's insane.
Yeah. That's wild. Okay. Well, let's let's rewind behind the modules then, and let's go back and talk about Node. How does one become a member of the technical steering committee?
So this is actually very, let's talk a little bit from scratch. So first of all, you need to become a Node.js collaborator. What does a collaborator do? A collaborator maintains Node. Node.js is maintained by the collaborator, is not maintained by the TSC. So the collaborator maintains Node, the collaborator decides how Node will evolve and set the technical and do the work. Okay, it's not the TSC that allocate tasks. It's not the role of the TSC to allocate tasks to the to volunteers. Because Node.js, contrary to all the other runtimes that you can think of, is a volunteer-based organization that everybody can join. And therefore, we need you to help, okay? You're watching, you're listening here. You're probably somebody that is familiar with Node.js. And if you like the framework, you should probably come and help us. We need all sort of kind of contributions, from doc to the website to infrastructure to Jenkins. If you love Jenkins, oh, we really need you if you love Jenkins, okay? We really, you know, just come and help, okay? So collaborators do all the work. And first, you need to become a collaborator. How does it do? You contribute. Node.js is an open organization, open governed. So you show up, you do the work, you get the commit bit.
You just go to GitHub and start pulling issues?
Pretty much, yes. That's how people do it. Okay. Typically, we start doing it by you doing workshops. So there is a workshop. We used to do this workshop called Code and Learn, but this has been iterated along and so on. Every now and then at a conference, we do a little bit of an exercise where we teach people to do their first pull request, and that's how it does. And then, you know, we set up their development environment, because setting it up, it's a lot of work to set it up.
Yeah.
To be honest, it's also, luckily, the new Macs helps a lot because they build very fast. We used to do it like 6-7 years ago, and those were very slow. Now the new Macs are super fast, so most people don't realize that they have a supercomputer on their backpack. And with way more core than what's healthy, so they can do whatever they want with it.
Yeah, I think my M2 is like 17 cores or some absurd number.
Yeah, some absurd number. Yeah. It's some absurd number. They have some absurd number of cores. I still have one M and one Max, and it's still absurd. Okay, so I'm not feeling it's. I'm not squeezing all the capacity from this one either. So, After that, you join the. So you don't join the TSC. TSC asks you to join. Typically, you are asked to join because of your contribution, the continuity of it, and the fact that you represent some part of the community of the project. Okay, and you have clear in your head what are the principles of the project, and you can make decisions for everybody. Now, what's the role of the TSC? The role of the TSC is to provide technical direction. What does it mean? Does it mean assign issues? It means we are going to ship ESM. Okay, this is the kind of technical. This is the kind of high level strategic decisions. Okay, then it does a little bit of coordination when coordination is needed. But more importantly, its usefulness is to resolve situations where the collaborators do not agree. Like when you have 100 plus collaborators, it's very hard that everybody can agree on a compromise when landing a change. So every now and then you need to, when two collaborators are not in agreement to land this PR or this other PR, or maybe they want to land somebody don't want a change to land, then that is the team and the pro, and we decide as a team, and the TSC makes a decision essentially.
How many people, so it's TSC, technical steering committee, how many people are on that committee?
Let me give you the exact number, because if you remember, there was some shuffling recently, so I will tell you 17, but I'm going to give you the exact number as of today.
It's not a crazy amount. 17. I mean, you can know everybody personally.
22 today.
22.
So, more people.
The number of contributors is just, there's a lot.
100 plus at this point.
Or collaborators, I guess is what we call
collaborators,
them.
Yes. The number of collaborators is 100 plus, so whatever. We have crossed, I think, issue 7,000, PR 50,000. So issue PRC 50,000 in GitHub. So, you know, it's great. At some point, they will need to add another zero in the label box. So for us, with 40,000 commits on the repo, it's crazy.
So you wrote a lot of code for Node back in the day as a collaborator, and then you came on to the technical steering committee.
You don't need to write a lot of, like, to be honest, okay? Let me give you a hint. I am the... I have 151 commits with 16,000 lines of code added, something like that, and 6,000 removed. And yeah. I am the 40th most prolific one in Node. So I didn't write a lot of it. Okay, I cannot claim that I've read a lot of Node itself because that would not be true. However, I am one of the maintainers of a few of the most critical areas of the project, and that's why I was added. Especially, I maintain streams and HTTP, which are probably stuff that everybody uses every day.
It's like part of the... I use a lot of Node. It's like standard, almost like standard library, but it's not, like, it does go deeper than just the JavaScript layer, right?
Yeah. It's a crossroad between JavaScript and C++. So.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And so did you actually write more JavaScript or more C++?
I tend to write, my C++ is pretty bad, so I tend to write more JavaScript, but... when I need to go C++, I wrote some of it, and then quite a few other of the collaborators jump in and fix it for me. Essentially, they kick my butt and they get me back into get the code back into shape.
I want to talk a little bit about incentives. A lot of the people listening to this podcast are very new to backend development, and they're kind of building open source projects, putting them up on their portfolio. But at least in my experience, talking with my community in the Discord, in our Discord community, a lot of people aren't really contributing to existing open source projects. They're kind of just building their own little pet projects. How do you think about the difference when it comes to, like, career opportunities between building your own project and going and finding a larger existing project and trying to make meaningful contributions?
I recommend people to join an existing project, mostly because they have a based community, okay? And you can piggyback on that massive community to quickly get a job related to that specific project that you like. Okay.
Yeah,
For Node core developers. There is a constant demand for framework authors. There is a constant demand. Like, people do not stay at home for long in those groups. Is what it's all about.
Are there projects out there? I think one thing that might be in kind of the junior developer's mind is, like, I'm not qualified to go work on Node, or I'm not qualified to make contributions to the Go standard library, right?
Who is qualified?
Is that?
I'm not going to speak for Go because they have a very odd community attitude. So I'm not. I would not speak for Go. Okay. So. If you don't try, you definitely won't be qualified, okay? And just to be clear, you don't need to be extremely good to contribute to open source. More importantly, you will have people that review your code and make you become way, way better if you contribute to open source, okay? Your skills will skyrocket the more, because, you know, people will review your code and give you an honest feedback, which typically is a big slap in the face. And then you learn how to take it, and then you make your code better. And the more it goes up, the better your code gets, and the less lap you get. And then at some point, you don't need it anymore.
In my experience, like, it's a lot of legwork, right? You've got to put in a lot of legwork. You've got to practice. You've got to go open those PRs.
Yeah.
But it is kind of free work experience, in the sense that, like, you'll actually have people communicating with you, giving you feedback, stuff that you'd only get on the job if you weren't contributing to open source, right? It's stuff that you can't really do on your own.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. How long ago did you first get involved with... Oh, yeah. No, go ahead.
You can start an open source, new open source project, but unless you know how the dynamics and the market works on how to promote it, nobody will check it out.
No one will care. Yeah.
Nobody will care. And I did a lot. Okay. Eventually, quite a lot of them became very popular. But my first attempts were absolutely disaster. So yeah. They were also very important to learn what not to do. So maybe getting a few disaster under your belt is not bad.
Yeah, generally speaking, the same is true of businesses. Like whether you're starting a for-profit business or just a free open source project, like if you don't have a plan for getting it in the hands of people, right? If there's not something interesting, some way to talk about it, it's very unlikely that anyone's going to care, in my experience. Cool. So can you explain some of the major differences, to get a little more technical now, between like a Node HTTP server and like a Python or a Ruby or a Go server? Take your pick. For those in my audience that are not very familiar with Node.
Oh, this is, so, okay. Node.js has basic capability for building API, for building HTTP servers. And then you need to typically layer down some sort of framework on top. And this is true also for Python, to be honest. Okay, mm-hmm. It's true for all languages. What is different from Node is, the key difference is NPM. Okay, you can take a look at all the stats, and there is a phenomenal amount of modules available to you to reuse or to get inspiration from on the NPM registry and in the prolific NPM community. This is not there
It's much larger. Yeah.
Okay, so a lot of stuff is bad, a lot of stuff is good, a lot of stuff is mediocre. Like you can get your pick, but at least there is. Okay, I think that is probably the biggest difference. It's not about how you build the APIs or you write your API. In the end, it's an HTTP API. Okay, it's JSON, it's REST representation state transfer plus JSON. So you need to add database connection, validations, open API, I don't know, logging. We can talk a lot about logging, okay? But apart from all of that, that's it.
Right? So in your mind, the biggest selling point, if we're talking to a new developer who's like, should I get started with Python backend development or JavaScript or Go? In your mind, the biggest selling point is NPM, big community, lots of projects to go look at and import. Or is there something else?
So from my point of view, I would say the community is probably the best thing for about JavaScript and Node. And I would not recommend, like, you should learn as many programming languages as you can, okay, as a junior. However, you can do it. Again, a lot of people can do it. Can learn it, okay. And there is a huge market available right now. Almost very few people find, you know, that this, you know, Node.js full stack devs go away very quickly. They can find jobs very easily. So I would. You know, it's growing. Okay. It's a market that is a growing market and so on and so forth. So I would not worry about it and just, you know, go ahead, because it gives you anyway a full stack view of your application. So you can do front end, you can do back end, and then you can move back and forth and without having to learn another completely new tool chain.
Yeah, that's always been one of the biggest selling points, right? That was really the inspiration for Node in the first place, right? It was like, we already are writing all this JavaScript on the front end.
Pretty well, there is that. Also, there is the fact that JavaScript-based, event loop-based, mm-hmm. was a right fit to solve the 10K connection problems back in the days. So,
Like comparing to PHP
Ruby and Python and so on and so forth. Now there are frameworks for doing event loop programming in Ruby and Python. So you can, but if you're not using them, probably you should do it. Okay.
That's so interesting that it kind of coincidentally just happens to be that way. Like the asynchronous nature of JavaScript had to be such a good fit for like IO based backend development.
It's based for all sort of things that is very much IO based. So it's just not, you know, because you schedule stuff and they will call you back when it's finished. This is one of the oldest pattern in software development. Okay. The fact that something gets blocked and gets scheduled, it's a fiction created by the operating system. So it's unreal. Okay. If you coded that build stuff for hardware devices or for kernel drivers, you know that in reality you need to wait for an interrupt to call you back. Okay. And that's how we work with devices at a low level. You talk to another device which is connected to you, okay, to your CPU, to your stuff, and you do you to the point of, oh, there is the RAM. The RAM is another device, okay? So if you want to have to read data to process it from the RAM, you need to run some instruction to load these data from the RAM to the registries in the CPU, okay? And then it you wait until that happens, okay? If you want to talk to the network card, to the disk, you says write this to disk, and in the meanwhile that gets, you know, you are called back. By the CPU, your CPU is the disk calls you back when the data is ready, okay, and send you an interrupt, and when the data is ready to be read, okay. So
I want to just like recap that, because I think it was a really important point. I want to make sure that especially like our newer developers aren't necessarily missing it. So you'd mentioned that the JavaScript event loop is a good fit to avoid some of these problems that kind of happened in, especially in like the early days of the web when web servers were more written in PHP and, yeah, and Ruby. And that has to do with this idea of an interrupt and a scheduling problem and kind of blocking and waiting for things. So I want to kind of like repeat what you said, and you can correct me where I'm wrong.
Okay,
so we can kind of get a second explanation of it. So if I need to do anything in my program that involves like contacting something external, and you're kind of defining something external at an even lower level than we normally think about it. Sometimes as web developers, we think of external as just like an HTTP request that's, you know, sent halfway across the world. But it can also mean, as you pointed out, like just going to the hardware within the machine, like going from the CPU to RAM or to disk. And those different things have certain amounts of blocking involved. And somehow that's related to the JavaScript event loop and asynchronicity. Can you make that connection really quick?
So we are all used about watching TV and watching high quality videos these days. Okay, you can see your video moving really fast. Okay, I don't know, 24 frames per second. Okay, 60 frames per second. Okay. You know that just recently Sony announced a camera that can do 120 frames per second. Okay, it's insane. Okay, so imagine like that. So, and we have screens that can render this speed. Okay,
yeah.
So this means your screen needs to be refreshed essentially 120 times per second. So this means that in order to provide good animations, good things, I need to be able to program code that can run 120 times per second. However, even going to the time that it takes to read a file from disk is over the one of 20, you know, it's
like the 20 milliseconds or whatever, actually less, right?
Less, yeah. Less, but at some point it start to matter, okay?
Yeah.
Because, you know, reading a file from disk is not just one operation, it's multiple operations. Okay, because in reality, if you want to read a file, you're reading it in chunks, and then you need to accumulate all the chunks, and your process is doing all these things behind your back. Okay, but all of these exist somewhere, and because of that, you know, you need the event loop on JavaScript event loop. The JavaScript asynchronicity was built with this concept in mind of, I need to render stuff very quickly because my displays need to be very quick in displaying it. So when there is stuff that's coming from the network on an event, they will call me back. They will call back, okay? The alternative, this is a model that was defined very early on in the history of UIs. And the alternative is essentially constant poll. And this is very CPU extensive. so expensive. So by the way, I think that model was done like this was another, you know, we are talking about very early days of computers. Okay, I think Windows 3.1.1 had the vent pump and stuff like that. Okay, just to clarify, like this is really old times. Okay, really old programming, old times in programming.
So like instead of like if I make, let's just use the example of an HTTP request. When I make an HTTP request, the runtime is going to tell me when it's done instead of me constantly having to ask to the runtime, hey, did that come back?
Or wait. So here's the point, okay? So you're writing your process. So JavaScript was run to building UIs, okay? Mm-hmm. And UIs have this constant key thing of being based on human interaction on one side, also fast refresh cycles and so on, which made certain decision on event loop and programming patterns that enables very quick turnaround and pause until something else happened and they will be called back in the future, okay? JavaScript was built with those concepts. Now, how does this reflect on the server? Back early 2000s, there was this massive problems of running a lot of connections on a single database. It was called the 10K problem, and it was first framed by folks behind Nginx, and they solved this problem to allow a lot of connection at the same time, because Apache could not, okay? Apache could not run multiple connections? Because every when you open a connection to Apache, there is a full thread blocked. Full thread also use memory, okay?
Full operating system thread.
Operating system thread use memory. It's like a small process. I'm just oversimplifying for juniors. It's a small process. It has its own memory space and so on, and it consumes a lot of CPU and takes some time to create. And you can only create a finite amount of them. Okay, that's the key part, important part. You can only create a finite amount of processes. Now, instead, an event loop based system, instead of creating a lot of processes, you are creating a lot. You only have one process, okay, one thread, that has the event loop, and then you basically tell this system tells the operator, instead of blocking on something to happen like a thread will do, a thread typically blocks on something to happen. An event loop based system says, no, operating system, when you have sent this data, you call me back. Okay, when this is a new HTTP call, is a new socket available, a new HTTP connection, you call me back. And this pattern changed the way we build, because now we can host, we can support tens of thousands of connection on the same process, same thread, because it has an event loop. And this has been found so good across all the industry. That's so far that now almost all language offers event loop based programming model for their HTTP servers, because that's the only way to handle a lot of different connections, because I can scale it. The cost of adding supporting one more connection, it's very minimal.
Yeah. For IO bound stuff, right, where most of what you're doing is like HTTP requests, waiting for a database, maybe even just waiting for disk, like this is phenomenal. Yeah. It's actually kind of funny that the Go's Go routines address a similar problem, but like kind of for a different problem space. So what I mean is, like, you have this problem with operating system threads, as you mentioned, that they're very heavy, right? And Go routines kind of address that problem of like, okay, we're not going to use the operating system threads, or rather we will, but we're also going to have our own kind of micro threading going on top of it. Where Go really shines is in like the compute heavy kind of side of that equation, whereas like Node is really, really good, at least from my perspective, at the IO stuff.
It's fast. It takes less time and energy to write stuff in Node than Go usually.
Right. Well, yeah. There's always the what language you prefer to write.
But also, we shipped worker threads in Node, so now you could even schedule a thread, do your CPU heavy stuff with Node, and get the result back. So you can have the best of both worlds.
Oh yeah, that's really cool. What are the things that you're most? Let me put it this way: you're on the technical steering committee in Node. I'm guessing the project is not perfect in your eyes. Like, what is your favorite part? Let's start with that. What is your favorite part of Node.js?
My favorite part of Node.js. This is hard.
the one thing you like wouldn't change, like you think it's in a really good spot, even if you could snap your fingers and change it, you just leave it alone.
None.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Maybe we need to go to the other side of the question first then. What's the thing that you would change if you could just change it?
All of it.
These are the worst answers ever, Matteo. Oh, or maybe they're the best ones.
Let me articulate this because it's just funny. So Node.js grow too fast, too quickly. Okay.
Okay.
We have found that quite a lot of stuff that the way it's used right now, it's suboptimal for various reasons, okay, in a few cases. And some of those APIs were built to support, were designed very quickly and never iterated upon, become massively popular, and then you can change them anymore. And right. Now you're stuck with them, okay? So it's a basically huge collection of APIs that got too quick, that got done too quickly.
Okay, they solidified too quickly, yeah.
They solidified too quickly. And now the whole world depends on those APIs.
Yeah.
So
it's just like a lot of little tweaks, I'm guessing, that you would like to make, but you can't really because of the usage.
Yeah, well, something that I would change, actually, that I actually would change completely, is the early days access, the early day concept to allow monkey patching of Node.js. Quite a lot of libraries used to monkey patch Node, and this was bad, okay, really bad, big, bad, even bad. And because of all this badness, things went down, like became life of the Node.js maintainers really hard, really impossible.
Developers are always asking to be able to hack stuff. And in my experience, it's almost always a bad idea. I maintain this Go project. It's a little wrapper for RabbitMQ.
Fun.
The little pub sub thing. Yeah, it's great. And I have to be extremely hard-nosed about what things I'm going to allow into the API, because it's a fairly high-level API, and I want it to be fairly beginner-friendly. People are always asking, like, well, just expose the internals so that I can consume them and use them. I'm like, no, because if I do that, then I'm not allowed to change the internals anymore. Or if I do, you'll be mad at me for breaking them later. So it's definitely a dangerous thing, and I kind of have a very small experience with what you're... Definitely not on the scale of Node, but same idea. I want to transition now a little bit. We've talked about Node. We've talked about your contributions there. You've started a startup. You're the CTO at Platformatic. Haha, said it right that time. What's the deal behind Platformatic? Let's just start there.
So the deal is writing APIs in Node is has not been massively innovated upon in the last few years. It's still more or less stuck in early days, in the early days mode. And what we plan to change all that and provide a simplified way of building APIs in Node.js that works out of the box. It has everything included, from metrics to OpenTelemetry to all the things, without compromising on performance and solidity of the solution, and also long-term maintenance. So,
does this compete with your old project? Does it compete with Fastify?
It's based on top of Fastify.
Oh, so, okay, cool.
Fastify is less opinionated, okay? It's a great tool to build a platform and to build platforms. That's exactly what I've been doing for quite a few years at Nearform before that. And then I decided to put my experience enough to pour all my experience into a product and start from scratch and build one that can be used by many instead of being a consultant and build one for each one of the clients.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So Platformatic, what is the, like, who is the ideal user of Platformatic? Is it a back-end dev that's looking to like simplify their workflows? Is it a team of front-end devs that wants to Firebase it up? Yeah.
It's typically either a full stack developer or a backend developer that needs to create new APIs typically quickly enough, and they are willing to take a solution that takes them in, I don't know, 80% there. And more or less, that's kind of the concept. And typically, they might be working in a team, and if they work in a team, they're probably interested in our in our paid products. But otherwise, if they're just working solo, they can just develop their things and get it done very quickly. And we go from building single service monoliths to modular monoliths to microservices. We have a tool to help with CRUD, so you can generate routes very quickly for your CRUD apps. And we'll ship more and more things in the next coming months. We have ways to create your own templates and to maintain your base stack for your for your API, so you don't need to reinvent the wheel every single time. So it's a great toolkit.
Yeah, no, it sounds cool. I want to get a little more specific because there's a lot of tools out there that kind of have a similar value prop in the sense that, like, for example, I've used Swagger, right? Where like I can specify what I want my API to look like in some like static document and then like generate a bunch of code. And the value proposition there is like, oh, you can spin up your backend really quickly. If we go down a level, what's it like in Platformic? Is it similar? Am I like writing a little spec and then generating code in JavaScript?
Yeah, the problem with code generator, okay. The problem with all code generators like that is that once you run the generated code, you cannot regenerate it, and you're basically stuck with your all the stuff that you generated on the first time.
Or you mean you can't edit the generated code?
No, you can edit in generated code, but you are not going to run the generator ever again. Okay.
So
the bigger your generator is, because you have edited it. Okay.
Right.
The bigger your generator is and it creates this scaffolding, the worse it gets.
You either need to just keep regenerating with edits from the source or never edit the generated code, right?
Yes, pretty much. So this is pretty bad in terms of long-term sustainability of those solutions. Fastify integrates in the Swagger Open API ecosystem in the sense that you can generate it out from it. You can ask for Platformatic, give me the current Open API schema of those block of routes, and it will spit it out. Okay.
Nice. Yeah.
But we are not telling you no. Give me that, and then you provide the code for those APIs. This is bad. Okay. It's just an approach that don't work. Like, you know, it's never a one-to-one comparison, okay? So generically, the flow that I recommend to devs is you go, you write your APIs, then from your Open API or your GraphQL, you generate your clients. We ship one client, an automatic client generator for Open API so that you can generate it very quickly, so you can save a lot of time. And once you have that stuff and you have composed your front-end app, your back-end app, just works. And you don't have to worry too much about everything.
This is something that I want to do more of. So obviously I've written a lot of Go. I'm primarily a Go developer, but one of my biggest pain points is not having like a Go generate command that generates all the TypeScript client stuff for all of my API endpoints, right?
So, okay, this is fun. You could use our client generator if your APIs just do Open API, you can use our client generation to get a client done for you.
Nice. Yeah. Cause like I'm sitting here, I'm like opening a browser. There's this really cool tool actually where you can paste in a Go struct and get the TypeScript interface. So I'm just doing it like manually, like a savage in 2023. So we'll definitely be iterating on that hopefully this year. Sounds really cool. Okay, cool. So definitely people want to check it out. They should check out Platformatic, not Platformic. As I've learned, is it a fully featured web framework? Like, should we compare it to Ruby on Rails with like Active Record, ORM, database stuff, or is it really?
We want to be better than Ruby on Rails, so.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'm not doubting that it's.
I'm not claiming it is.
I'm not a Ruby dev, but my point is like. Is it trying to be minimalist and just handle the HTTP layer?
No, Fastify is the thing that manages the HTTP layer.
Okay.
Platformatic wants to be something more. Okay. It's one step above that. We have a tool to automatically create REST APIs and GraphQL APIs from your database, similar to tools like Supabase and Azure, with a key difference. This one, the one we have, is fully editable and scriptable in JavaScript from within the same process. So you don't need to invent to add function or add other things. You can just run JavaScript from within your project. It's super customizable. So you can start with your scaffolded routes and just add what's missing and changing and so on and so forth. This is great. Like, this is the thing that people loved most from Ruby on Rails, for example, because you could very quickly generate everything out. But then the things went spiraled quickly out of control because, you know, you could not keep up to date. So, and the generated code. And this is why we generate way less code in Platformatic. Everything is mostly computed at runtime for those routes. And so, it was better from my point of view.
So I'm trying to like categorize it in my head. So it sounds like it's less like heavy-handed and productized, I don't know if that's the right word, than like a Supabase or a Firebase, but it's more out of the box than something like a Fastify or an Express. The word framework can be awfully confusing.
Absolutely.
It's a terrible, terrible word. Okay, very cool. Is it built on top of a specific, because like, for example, Supabase is kind of built on top of Postgres and Firebase only has its very specific database, Firebase, that it supports. Are you trying to make that agnostic or are you locking in on
it? It's agnostic. So if you use, so we have Plasmatic DB, which is this automatically HTTP routes for your data to access to your database. That is supports all the things. So I support MariaDB, MySQL, Postgres, and SQLite. If you want to support Oracle, yes, no problem. But we will ask you for a check first, and then we can do Oracle. But you already used to pay money, so you can pay us some for Oracle support.
No, very cool. That's always. There's like this when you're just starting a project. I this can be a trap when you're just starting a project, especially as like a junior dev or just for fun. Like, obviously you want to use free tools. And I think that's smart. As a company, sometimes it can be a trap to only want to use free tools because you can get left hanging if the project isn't sustainable. So, something being paid is definitely not always a bad thing in the commercial world.
No, actually, it's actually pretty good.
Yeah. There are some companies that are like, oh, this is free. I don't know if we want to use it. Like, we want someone that we can call when there's an outage, right?
Yeah.
And get it taken care of. I saw this recent video you posted up on your YouTube, Adventures in Node Land, Matteo Colina. The title of the video is How to Make Your Node.js API 5x Faster. Can you back up that claim?
I knew you were asking that, and yes and no at the same time. So let's talk about it. Let's discuss a little bit how that works. Okay. So this is one of the phenomenal reasons why Node.js is great and why event loop technology, things, application built on the event loop can do things that trade-based systems cannot. So you're running on the same thread, right? So but multiple requests are running inside the same thread. So yep. When you do that kind of pattern, those two requests can access the same data structures. So they can read and write the same data structure without having resorting of locking or any other synchronization concerns. Now, usually for safety reason, most developers can tell you, oh, but never cross the streams, right? You know, otherwise you get a lot of popcorns. This is the typical anecdote from Node.js developers. But when you do cross the streams, you could get something very magical happening at that specific point in time, which is great. Why? Well, you cross the stream and ultimately you can say, oh, but I have a HTTP request that wants certain data. There is another one that was the same data. So instead of fetching it twice, I just fetched them once.
Yeah.
This is the magic, okay?
And if we were smart, like, we'd write that into the application layer or we'd be more careful about it. But in my experience, no one does that, and we're going to be duplicating requests all the time.
Pretty much. And we just shipped this feature in Plasmatic DB, which is our ORM-ish layer, which is not an ORM, but technically, but it's our database access layer.
It's like so the word framework. It's just, yeah.
So that if two microservices execute the same SQL query, the same query, we with the same values inside, we then flip it back and just deduplicate that call and make it super fast, because we are avoiding like going to the database, processing a lot of effort. And these more or less give a 5x step on it. We plan to ship it across all our product, this technique to ship it across all our products. So, and it will happen. And that's
crazy. So it's really like the crux of the problem is just, we're essentially, I mean, it's not quite caching. It's kind of caching. It's deduplication. Right?
Yeah. Well, it's a deduplication is a form of caching with no
timeouts. So. Right. Okay. And that's five. That means that, like, as application level developers, in order for that to be true, application developers need to be making like 80% unnecessary requests almost, right?
Well, yes. But typically, if you look, this is true for most websites or for most APIs, because most of the calls are the same call.
Okay? Yeah.
I don't know.
It's not user specific, right? It's like every user is requesting the same page. Initially.
Every user is accessing their own page. Every user is accessing the product page. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's really interesting. Because, yeah, like when you write an HTTP handler, you're hitting the database one time and you have 10,000 users. So they're all hitting the database 10,000 times.
Yes.
Cool. No, that's great to hear. Go check out the video. I will make sure to link it down in the description below. My last question that I just kind of want to wrap up with is, what's you seem to have a lot of opinions, which I think is awesome.
I do.
What's your most unpopular opinion in 2023 when it comes to web development in general? What are you most hated on when you post it on Twitter?
Oh, what was the most hated on in 2023?
Yeah, so you have an opinion in 2023. You posted on Twitter. If you posted on Twitter, what's the opinion you'd get the most hate for?
Oh. Possibly that if you're writing TypeScript and forcing 100% correctness or 100% type safety is an absolute waste of time, and you should not be spending a day or two to fix a type if you are only or if your team is your only primary consumer of that line of code. If you're writing a framework, there is different things to be considering. But if you're not,
yeah, if you're an
application level developer should not spend absurd amount of time fixing types in at any time. Just focus on shipping features. If TypeScript does not comply, slap an ignore or an any and keep going.
So I'm guessing you're first of all, are you a TypeScript fan? Do you use?
No.
Just raw dog the JavaScript.
Yeah, I just do all JavaScript. I just write the types when I want code to run in your IDE. So TypeScript is code that runs inside your IDE.
Yeah.
So, and it allows for fancy macros or fancy syntax sugar, which is great. Okay, I'm not saying it's not. It's great.
That's
it's
the unpopular opinion. You should have given me that one. The other one was like watered down. It's like, if you're using TypeScript, it's okay to use an any. This one's like, just don't use TypeScript.
Well, I'm saying, I'm saying if you want, I'm not saying you don't use TypeScript. I'm just saying I'm not, for the type of software that I write is usually.
Oh, you don't write TypeScript for your, but you think it's a good idea for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a good idea for a lot of people. Just not my thing, but it's a good idea for a lot of people, especially application developers. We give them a productivity boost, so it's a good thing.
Yeah,
but also not something to be very zealot about. OK, kind and be and stuff.
Yeah. Damn it! I was so excited. I was gonna tweet that out. It was gonna be awesome. And then it got watered down a little bit. Probably a better take.
What though. If you want it's another one? A much more controversial opinion. Okay, is you should not be shedding types between your client and server.
Oh, that is controversial. I like this. Tell me why.
Okay, if you want, mostly because it creates a tight coupling between your client and your server on types.
Yeah.
Okay.
Why don't I want that? Don't I implicitly kind of have a typing coupling?
Wait a second.
Wait. Go for it.
But your typing coupling is based on a language that does not follow semantic versioning, that breaks every 2 months, and was essentially is absolutely not stable as a target. So it forces your client and your server to keep all the libraries up to date at the same time. And very often, unless you're working solo or in a very tight team, you want to develop your API at a speed and your front end at another. And therefore, you don't want a tight coupling. You want a loose coupling within the two, which can be achieved using GraphQL or OpenAPI or, I don't know, some other format that you can decide later on, but something that is codified as a data file, like a JSON or a YAML or an XML file, even if you're passing me the term, but not type that needs to be interpreted to be defined. And the tight coupling is bad. Generically, if you look at is tight coupling good, typically the response is it depends or it's bad. Okay, you don't want tight coupling between different parts of your applications. Okay, and especially over a network. So
I like that take. Yeah, I'm gonna have to think about it more because I haven't given it the thought that it deserves. But now I'm gonna have to dig.
Been the explosion of these type safe libraries that create a tight coupling between the client and the server.
Mm-hmm.
And this is great. They are great. Okay. They work great for solo developers, indie, for people that just need to act something by themselves. Okay. But then they fall short very quickly after when complexity grow, and then you need to, have a team of maintainers for one thing and have a team of maintainers for another. So
right.
They don't scale in complexity. Okay. Very funnily, I was chatting about this with the author of TRPC, and he essentially agrees with me. So he says, but
oh wow,
there's a huge market in the people that write solo software for themselves. Okay,
because TRPC is a tightly coupled, like that's its whole thing.
And they
right?
say yeah. that sits in the box, and it's tightly coupled, and you need to know what you're buying essentially, and if that works for you, then it's fine. It's a great choice. Okay. The problem is it's tight coupling, and if you plan that API to be reused by somebody else that doesn't sit next to you, that's not part of your small team, then probably not the right choice for your technology stack. Okay?
Got it. That's fantastic. Thanks for that. I'll be doing some more thinking about it.
I hope I gave you the hot take you wanted, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for coming on, Matteo. This has been absolutely fantastic. Where can people find your stuff? Go ahead and plug your most recent projects.
So you can find me on Twitter. Typically, I tweet a lot at Matteo Collina. Okay. Typically there I have a YouTube channel, Twitch, newsletter. You can find all the links at nodeland.dev. You can find all the stuff about my company at platformatic.dev, and that's there.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Matteo. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. This is great. I love being here, and I hope you enjoyed having me, and happy to be back to talk about more stuff whenever you want.
Yeah, this will definitely be, I think next year we'll have to have another one and talk about some more technical stuff. This was great.
Oh, yeah, whenever. We can go very deep if you want. Very. We can talk about some nitty-gritty of stuff.
I'll have to prepare myself. I'll need to study up so I don't look too dumb. Cool. Thanks, Mateo. Have a great one, man.
Yeah, perfect.